we do need much more regulation now than we had in the recent past before this crash occurred. And I think this legislation at least moves in that right direction.
Welcome to the Alter Group Podcasts on Real Estate. I'm your host, Tom Silva. Today, our guest is Anthony Downs, Senior Fellow with the Brookings Institution. A real estate finance expert, Tony focuses his research on smart growth, traffic congestion, and metropolitan policy. He was previously Chairman of the Real Estate Research Corporation, and before that, a Senior Analyst with the RAND Corporation. Tony, I want to open by asking you a devil's advocate question about financial reform. The recession stopped three decades of international capital markets expansion. So from 1980 to 2007, the world's financial assets, we're talking about equities, public and private debt, bank deposits, quadrupled relative to GDP. And during that time, we had millions of people around the world lifted out of poverty. In a country like India, for example, poverty was cut in half. So the question is, all of this occurred in an essentially increasingly deregulated environment. So why is it that we feel that the system is broke if it yielded unparalleled economic growth? Why do we need to fix it? Wouldn't it be enough to just address the abuses of the system, but in a more incremental way?
Well, part of the increase in lending, increase in activity, which led to higher living standards for many people, was based on an increase in lending, which is in turn based on highly leveraging the deals that were made. That is, using borrowed money for a very high fraction of the deals that were made. If you bought a building for $100 million, you borrowed 70% or 80% of it, sometimes even more than that. And that meant that there weren't very many reserves standing behind each loan. And as a result of the bank ratio of total loans made to reserves rose to almost 30 to 1 in the late period between 2000 and 2007. And that meant that there really weren't adequate reserves underneath these loans. And it also meant that when the loans roll over now, the banking system cannot refinance them, because if you had made loans with a 70-80% loan-to-value ratio, and now the government is forcing you, or the markets are forcing you down to a 50% or less ratio, you can't make as many loans with the same amount of reserves. So all those large numbers of loans that were made from 2000 to 2007 or 2006, 16 times as many commercial property loans were made as in the preceding 6 years. Mm-hmm. That's a huge increase, and that means that when these loans come due over the next few years, the banking system will not be able to roll them over, because it's going to be forced to hold higher reserves, and it will not be able to make that much lending. The banking system's capacity to loan has been shrunk drastically by the attempt to deleverage their books. Now, not all the deleveraging has actually occurred. The banks are still having fairly high leverages compared to their historic norms. But the reason why that's bad is that it makes you, if you have very low reserves, you don't have much protection against any adverse circumstances that occurred. And, of course, when the adverse circumstances occurred in about 2006, the loans started to go bad. And that's what launched us into this giant crisis. So we went too far. We were living beyond our means, and the whole world, in a certain sense, was living beyond its means. And that's not sustainable. That's why, although it's true that since about 1975, there's been a huge increase in the standard of living throughout the world, and that's quite important. And it is one of the largest increases in welfare in the history of the human race, but we went too far.
So take us through the financial reform. Is this a reinstatement of the Banking Act of 1933, what we call Glass-Steagall, which ended up being rolled back in 1999?
No, it is not just a restatement of it. I'm not sure whether, I think that banks are still allowed to deal in securities to some extent. The Glass-Steagall would have prevented that. But no, there are lots of other things that are being done, attempted by this law. For example, one of the most important is the handling of derivatives. A financial derivative is a security based on the performance of some other financial security. And the financial derivatives previous to this law, if it's passed, were carried out by individuals on both sides of a deal without having to register at any exchange or without having to have any filed reserves or without any information. So none of the regulators knew how many derivatives or what kinds of derivatives were actually in being. Now, under this law, they're going to have to register those derivatives with exchanges, and that means they have to go through some kind of an exchange for the maintenance of records on who is borrowing money from whom and under what terms.
Tony, I want to ask you about this whole notion of too big to fail. There's currently $13.3 trillion being held by the 10 largest banks. But a lot of them, of course, have repaid their TARP money, about $194 billion in repayments, and they have excess reserves, I'm talking about the largest banks here, of $1 trillion. So why are we concerned about the large banks at this point? Haven't they essentially done a good job of going through the stress tests and putting their house in order?
They're still not making loans at nearly the extent that they were even before 2000. And the banking system still has on its books many assets of dubious quality that they're not willing to sell, because if they sold them, they'd have to admit how worthless they were, what low values they had. And they're not making loans. If you try to go out and borrow money to repay your $100 million loan that's coming due, you can't. There's no one will make you the loan. So the banking system is not returned to normal at all, in my opinion.
Isn't part of the problem mixed messages? The government is saying lend, while the regulators are saying shrink your balance sheet.
I think that the regulators are concerned about the excess leverage that the banks had in the period, as I described, when their ratio of reserves to loans went up from $1 for every $30 of lending. That was too reckless and too dangerous, and the regulators are concerned about that. And the federal government wants the banks to lend again, because the businesses of the country need to borrow money. And so I don't think it's a mismanagement. It's a conflict of two different things. One is to increasing the reserve behind the bank's lending, and the second is to stimulate their lending. Now, those two things are in tension with each other. But I don't think it's because the managers are being stupid about it. It's that those are both legitimate objectives, but unfortunately operates against the other to some extent.
Tony, one of the catchphrases that's emerged in our industry is pretend and extend, this notion that banks can pretty much write it out. Give us a sense of why that's happening and what needs to be done to address that.
This is part of banks carrying on their books assets that are not really worth what they're carrying on the books, and the Congress allowed them to change the accounting principles so they wouldn't have to value the assets they're holding at market price, but they could value them at the historic price they paid for them. And that is overstating the assets held by many of these banks, the true value of those assets. But that's freezing the banks from making any loans, because they can't sell these assets and they can't use the reserves being held against the assets to sponsor other loans, so they're sort of frozen.
Tony, do you think we're likely to see another RTC, the Resolution Trust Corporation, between 1989 and 1995, during that last major recession, closed or reorganized 747 institutions, selling about $400 billion in assets? Do you think we're likely to see an RTC again?
I think we will. It isn't clear to me yet, because we don't really know what the assets the banks are holding. They're not telling us, and the government is not revealing what it really found in the stress tests. So we don't know what kind of assets these banks are holding. If they're holding assets that are way underwater, then we may need an RTC. I think it's quite possible that that will be one of the things that will emerge in the next couple of years.
Tony, let's talk a little bit about what's going to happen with derivatives. Blanche Lincoln wants the banks to spin off their derivatives trading desks. It's about a $600 trillion market. And as part of separating investment banking from commercial banking, give us your perspective on
this. Well, I think if the derivatives market is changed by making all activities go through exchanges and putting reserve requirements on the people who are making, for example, credit default swaps, and requiring them to all these transactions to be recorded, that it probably is not necessary to eliminate the banks from derivative activities. But it is necessary to make the changes I just suggested, because otherwise they can run wild, and which they did. And we had up to $62 trillion in credit default swaps outstanding, which is much more than all the securities in the entire world. And that we have to avoid that. I don't think that it's necessary to completely eliminate them from the derivatives business, particularly certain kinds of derivatives like interest rate swaps and futures purchases by farmers are perfectly legitimate, and the banks, there's no reason why they couldn't be in that business.
Tony, I want to ask you about the mortgage-backed securities market and how you think the bond market needs to be regulated in order to prevent some of the abuses we saw.
I think securitization should be limited by different kinds of rules. The number one rule is that the persons making the securities or creating them and selling them has to hold on to a certain fraction of the securities themselves. The Congress is talking about 5%. I think it should be closer to 10%. But even so, securitization is still a dangerous process, because when you divide up a loan into all these little pieces, and then when something goes wrong, it becomes very, very difficult to fix it. And so I think there should be limits on securitization, but it's very hard to do that except for saying that the issuers have to hold on to a piece of the action.
Tony, one of the criticisms of reform has been the fact that it ties the hands of our depository institutions. It means that they cannot compete on a level playing field with securities firms or even foreign financial institutions. How do you respond to that?
Well, I don't care whether they have an unfair disadvantage. Use the privileges that they would have if they could get in securities to make excessive loans and do what they just did, I think that that's a very, very dangerous thing. Look what it's costing the country. And so I don't think they necessarily have to have the same privileges as investment banks. And also, investment banks need to come under more regulations. They should have a lot more reserves against what they do.
Now, does the reform that you're discussing really limit the sources of liquidity to our economy? I mean, think about small businesses. They represent 45% of the job losses, and most of the capital that they require to keep their lights on comes from the float of things like home equity or credit cards or SBA loans. Tell us about how this is going to play out.
Well, we have to do a lot less lending in the future than we did from 2000 to 2006. We were excessively lending money and doing that by holding a very small amount of reserves and leveraging it up to, as I said, 30 to 1. We can't keep doing that. And, of course, that means that it's going to be harder for people to borrow money. Everybody, but it will particularly probably affect small business. It doesn't mean they won't be able to borrow money at all. It just means they can't borrow as much money in relation to the reserves held by the banks as they did in the period 2000 to 2006.
Now, what part does the Fed play in all of this?
Greenspan was the Fed, as for all practical purposes, and he contributed to the crisis in two ways. The first way, and the most important in my opinion, was that when he was told by Ned Gramlich, who was a member of his own board, that there was fraud going on in the subprime market in 2001 and again 2003 or 4. And Gramlich said, you better do something about this. And Greenspan said, no, I'm not going to do anything because I don't believe in regulation. And that was a terrible mistake. And it meant that all of the horrible loans that were made in the subprime market could go on unchecked. That was his first big mistake. The second mistake was that interest rates were driven fairly low. I don't think by the Fed. The interest rates were driven low by an enormous inflow of capital into the U.S. economy, both from abroad, from all kinds of excess savings abroad, and by a flight out of the stock market after the crash of 2000. And all this money coming into real estate caused drove the prices of properties up and destroyed the process of underwriting intelligently and evaluating risk intelligently before making a loan or buying a property. And that was caused not by Greenspan, but by just the huge inflow of capital. If you have so much capital coming into the country, it drives down interest rates. Now, Greenspan's error was to keep the interest rates low for a longer period than he probably should have. And that was a mistake. I don't think it's as big a mistake as his neglecting the subprime markets, however.
So the Fed today has doubled its balance sheet in the last 18 months. Give us a sense of where you think they stand.
Well, I think Bernanke is faced by a terrific dilemma. One is, if he has to keep interest rates low in order to facilitate borrowing by corporations that he wants to keep the economy operating. The other is that by keeping interest rates low and by increasing the amount of money in circulation, that he is increasing the federal deficit, and the federal deficit is really out of control. And those two things, he eventually, in order to prevent inflation, he would have to start raising interest rates. But so far, he doesn't think the economy is strong enough to do that yet. And it puts him in a dilemma where the country needs to spend more money in order to stimulate more activity with all the unemployed we have. And the federal government would like to spend money on energy policy and other things in order to reduce unemployment, but they can't do that without running big deficits. And that's a dilemma for which there's no obvious solution. And the Federal Reserve has just a very terrible decision to make. When do we start reducing the flow of liquidity into the market by raising interest rates? And they're afraid to do that now in order to avoid causing more unemployment. Yet, if they don't do it, I'm not so worried about inflation as I am just about the dilemma of the rising deficit. That seems to me is a real dilemma. And Bernanke has to be considered a hero in the sense that he stepped into the market and saved the day when we were really going down the tubes. But I don't think that they did it very well because, for example, when they advanced all this money to the banks, they didn't put any conditions on it. And they didn't say to the people who were receiving the federal funds, well, like when they lent money to AIG. AIG had all these credit default swaps with people. So AIG just took the federal money and paid off, for example, Goldman Sachs, $13 billion in their credit default swaps. Well, the government should have said, you can pay off debts, but you can only pay off 50 cents on the dollar or something like that to force the other people to experiencing some suffering too, but they didn't do that. They didn't put any limits on how many bonuses could be paid by the banks. So I think it was correct for them to spend more money into the system, but they should have put more limitations on it. But right now they're faced with a very, very difficult decision, and I think Bernanke is about as good at making that decision as. Certainly as good as I am.
Tony, one of the big issues is the future of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. Now, Bloomberg is reporting that the cost of the bailout on the low end is at about $160 billion, but could grow to as much as $1 trillion. Give us a sense of what's going to happen to these two mortgage companies that last year bought or guaranteed about 3/4 of all U.S. home loans.
Well, right now, Freddie and Fannie are providing all the funding for mortgage loans in the housing industry. Almost every loan every house that's sold uses borrowed money, and the money eventually comes from Freddie and Fannie. Therefore, I think that in order to protect the housing industry, the government is going to have to hold on to both those agencies. Now, they may change their format and maybe merge them or break them up into smaller parts, but I believe the government is going to maintain control over them and ownership of them, and will not return them to the private sector, at least not in the foreseeable future. And that's probably necessary to sustain the housing market. As you know, a very high percentage of all deals in housing are based on borrowed money, and Freddie and Fannie are supplying all that money. Right now, nobody else could guarantee the loans or stand behind the loans because they don't have the federal guarantee, whereas Freddie and Fannie have it. So I believe that the government will maintain its ownership of Freddie and Fannie, and that they're done as private organizations.
Tony, I want to ask you finally about the consumer. Right now, the ratio of consumer spending, which of course we should point out includes healthcare, is north of 70% of GDP. And this comes at a time, of course, when we've lost 8.5 million jobs. And where do you think that's going to lead us in terms of our economy? Are we going to see a tilt away from consumer spending being the lion's share of our GDP towards, say, an export-based economy? Give us a sense of what you're seeing in the future.
We've got to reduce that percentage. Traditionally, even in the 1990s, the consumer spending was around 62-63% of GDP. So when it went up to 70, that was part of the explosive lending we were doing.